from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour will be made next year, July 25th, 2016, in Philadelphia, the Democratic National Convention, and by then we will know if what seems inevitable, or at least really obvious, will come to pass. Will the Democrats nominate Hillary Clinton for president? And if they do, what kind of primary process would benefit them as they move to the general election? This is the first of some many conversations we'll have on this program about upcoming elections, the presidential process, and we often like to stick to the policy, but we're going to talk a little bit about the horse race, and we're going to talk to some people who have some very diverse and important perspectives on this. Especially three of our four panelists do have dogs in the fight. One doesn't. And that's what will make it pretty fun this hour. We're going to start going around the table with Anthony Plonzinski. He's a campaign and policy consultant and the city Democratic leader in the Monroe County Democratic Party. Anthony, welcome back. Nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Ken Warner's here. He's a local activist, author, blogger, former executive director of Unicon, a construction and building and trades group. Ken, nice to see you.
Good to see you, Evan.
Also in studio is Jesse Lenny, the upstate regional political director of the Working Families Party. Jesse, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
And the adjudicator this hour is Rob Shum. Rob is a professor of political science at the college at Brockport. Rob, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
All right. Well, let me just start with this here. Does anybody in this room think it will not be Hillary Clinton? I'm not saying, you know, if you think it's possible. I'm thinking if you're betting right now, does anybody think it will not be Hillary Clinton?
Betting on it? No. No.
You don't think the recent email kerfuffle or anything else will get in your way?
You know, on basically I've got a couple of articles that I brought with me that I wanted to show you. Last year at this time, it was Benghazi that was going to bring her down. In today's 24-hour news cycle, this email thing has the length of time of an ice cube.
But is it a legitimate question for you? Are you concerned about it?
Yeah, because I want to know what she was talking about her yoga classes, I mean, really.
You don't think there was anything of substance that we don't know that she didn't hand over?
She had 32,000 emails. I'll bet you that somewhere in there was something that you don't know, Evan. Even you.
I knew I invited the right people to this panel today. So at least everybody thinks it will be Hillary Clinton. But here's the Boston Globe just yesterday. They flooded the zone, so to speak. Three different editorials, op-eds, just pushing Elizabeth Warren. Senator Warren, you've got Jesse, you're holding the same stuff there?
Yep.
All right, so they are exhorting Elizabeth Warren, Senator Warren, to run for president. Elizabeth Warren has said many times, and I've got a pile of articles in which she has denied that she wants to be in the race, that she wants to be represented in it. Okay, but Jesse, let me ask you then. Do you want to see Elizabeth Warren run for president?
Yeah, the Working Families Party, New York Working Families Party, recently joined a national campaign to draft her to run, and who better to know her than the Boston Globe, and who better to help us draft her than the Boston Globe that helped draft her to run for Senate in the first place? So we're very hopeful that she'll change her mind. We take her at her word that she is not in the race right now, but we feel that with a strong call from the progressive community and from organizations like ours across the country, we can get her to change her mind.
If she is the 1A candidate in the Democratic field right now, it is a strong one versus any 1A, 1B, 1C. How could she overcome the deficits she would be facing in fundraising in just the early numbers? I mean, would she be a viable contender, Jesse?
Yes, we believe she'd definitely be a viable contender. She's got a track record of small donor fundraising, amazing small donor fundraising. We think that she's got the right message. She's challenged. She's probably the top person in Congress challenging the banks, challenging inequality, challenging Wall Street, taking on student debt, and a number of other issues that are hitting the American working families really hard. So we think with that she can galvanize the support she needs to overcome, you know, a substantial opponent.
Rob, as an observer of political science and a professor of political science, is this conversation a waste of time? Is Hillary Clinton the candidate, or will there be at least a process that challenges her?
Well, I mean, I guess the first thing to point out is really too soon to tell. And the second point is that, yeah, it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see. I think a lot of the dynamic will depend on how frightened are progressive voters really of the prospect of a Republican president. If they are, then they're going to rally behind Hillary. If they actually have stronger memories of the year 2000, then there will be a drift and flirtation with a Nader type of candidate. And we'll see how far that, you know, persists into the campaign.
I think that's an interesting comment. And Jesse, as someone, again, who's supporting Elizabeth Warren, is Hillary Clinton too conservative a candidate for you and the Working Families Party?
I don't think we can say that yet. What we want is, what's important to us is that we get a candidate like Elizabeth Warren into the race so that all Democratic candidates have to address the issues that she's been a champion of. And that's what we're hoping that this effort will accomplish.
But if I could, because what you're offering is this, you'd love to see Elizabeth Warren win. But if she runs, at least you get your voice heard. At least that part of the conversation, that pressure on the party might move in certain issues. Is that fair to say?
I think what we're confident in is that if she runs, the issues that are important to us will have to be debated. And then once they're debated, us and along with all Americans will be able to make a decision.
But that's what we heard in the Democratic governor race here in this state last year. And when Zephyr Teachout was running, when the Working Families Party supported Andrew Cuomo and wanted that same kind of issue, they wanted a seat at the table. Even all the while, the governor telling the Washington Post that if you go left of the Working Families Party, you fall off the planet. That's a quote from Governor Cuomo.
The left of himself, I think.
But I'm asking you then, is that mentality a flawed one where you say we're going to back a candidate or we're going to try to at least influence the conversation? Should you back a candidate that you truly believe in versus one who's more of a pragmatic candidate like the party seems to have done with Andrew Cuomo?
I think we do. We're going to be about 1,500 candidates apply for our endorsement this year, and over the last 16 years, probably 10,000-12,000 candidates. So every race is different, and the gentlemen in the Democratic Party know, but we have even more candidates. In some races, we have both sides apply, and all their candidates apply. So every race is different, and this is a completely different race. It's much further. We're much further out from this race than we were in June.
Yep.
Before the governor's race. So I think it's hard to draw parallels. It would be hard for me to draw parallels. And there's no rule. There's a tension in the WFP where we think you have to win elections in order to affect policy. And so we know we have to win. We want to win with the best candidates possible, and we want to make sure that our issues are discussed and addressed once people win. But it's complicated and difficult.
Was the Cuomo endorsement a mistake?
I wouldn't say. What I would say is what our leaders have said is that our state committee, which is a very democratic process, made the best decision they could. They could at the time, given what they knew. We lost some elections. You know, we lost some really good senators. We lost Ted O'Brien here in Rochester. We lost Terry Gibson in the Hudson Valley by a mere 5%. And when you lose elections, you don't get what you want. I mean, we believe elections matter. We believe you have to win to get the minimum wage, to get the DREAM Act, to get women's equality. And we didn't win those elections. So, that's why I wouldn't say it was a mistake. I would say that we had some tough elections, and we have to win more elections if we want to deliver on the agenda that we committed to.
Anthony Planzinski, you promised me that somebody would disagree over this, but everybody seems to agree that Hillary is not beatable as a candidate right now. Do you want to see an active? What's that? All right, we'll see that. There you go, Jesse. There we go. Mix it up a little bit. But do you want to see an active primary? Do you want to see a competitive primary, even if Hillary Clinton emerges as the Democratic candidate?
Personally, I'm a firm believer in competitive primaries. I think that it really, really kind of weeds out any of the issues that are there. We get to vet our candidates in a very thorough way. And I think no matter what, I think there's 2008 still looms over this race. Hillary Clinton is still a candidate that lost the presidential nomination in 2008, and it was to a more populist candidate in the current president, President Barack Obama. And there was a reason for that. She started out as strong as she's starting now. A lot of folks thought, unbeatable, she is it. You know, how dare this young senator come and challenge her? And I think that there were a lot of things that President Obama presented in that race that had folks switch to her side. Now, I have no kind of illusions of grandeur that New York is not going to go for Hillary Clinton. But I think that it's interesting enough that right now New York's second choice, who we haven't really talked about today, is Governor, former Governor O'Malley from Maryland. And so when you look at that and you see that there are other options out there, you know, we could be one mistake away from a new candidate at the forefront of things. And so nothing is set in stone. Nothing is 100% locked in. Yes, Hillary Clinton is definitely the favorite right now, and she represents a lot of things that Democrats really want to see forward. But we still also have our own internal struggle of, are we representing the issues of the people, or are we representing issues of more corporate America, as Jesse says as well. And so I would, even though I wouldn't bring up Elizabeth Warren in that fact, I think, Jesse, that they're all over that. But I think O'Malley is an interesting dark horse in this race.
All right. I'm glad to start getting to some of the other names, and we're going to get back to Martin O'Malley in just a moment, because if Elizabeth Warren doesn't run, Matthew Iglesias, writing in Vox this week, says Martin O'Malley is running the campaign that a lot of Democrats want Warren to run. When we talk about going beyond Dodd-Frank, when we talk about the kind of legislation that is much more stern when it comes to Wall Street. We're going to get to that in a moment about some of these other ideas. But let me kick it back to our political science professor. And Rob, Anthony is saying 8 years ago, we were all sitting here saying, well, it's almost inevitable it'd be Hillary Clinton. Is there a lesson from history that we shouldn't assume that this is absolutely a done deal yet?
Well, yeah, I think what Anthony's bringing up is that anything could happen. I mean, just going back to what Ken was saying at the beginning, clearly it's possible that this is a melting ice cube, this email issue. But on the other hand, you can imagine all kinds of scenarios in terms of if something comes out where there was a serious security breach, you know, that threatens national security, involving hacking or something like that, you know, that mouse cube will recongeal, I think, pretty quickly. So you can imagine all kinds of things happening. It is a crazy, eventful world. So I absolutely agree with that.
Okay. And the one difference, it appears that this panel thinks that 8 years ago, Hillary Clinton had the big lead, lost, and there wasn't a scandal. There wasn't, mm-hmm. you know, one event that changed it and opened the door. It was a slow build for Barack Obama, and he beat her. In this case, it seems like the panel thinks if she is not going to win, it would take a moment like that. Though, could Elizabeth Warren pass her over time without a scandal?
Well, I think one thing to point out, I think, is it seems very clear that the establishment has lined up behind, the party establishment, the Democratic Party establishment has lined up behind Hillary, that there really isn't much of an alternative, that anybody is floating any trial balloons or whatever. And you know, Martin O'Malley, with all due respect, he's running for vice president, and he's doing a good job doing that, I think. But there's not really a serious challenge.
Are you going to take that, Anthony?
Castro would probably have a different say that. There's a lot of folks who will be running for vice president. I think the professor brings up a good point. I mean, there are folks running for vice president or running for president in a lot of entities in situations. But, you know, I do think, though, you know, though O'Malley may be running for vice president, it's a plausible thought. There's no saying, you know, I would bet $1,000 that if Hillary fell out the race and he was right there, he's going to say, well, I'm going to be president. You know, I think people are there for the certain circumstance and situation, which is why we still see that Vice President Joe Biden still has not said, I'm not running. And you would think he's a Democratic establishment person. He's a stalwart. He's the current vice president. Why would he say he's not running? You know, you can make the argument he's running to be vice president still.
You're asking two questions, though. One of the questions is, if you're saying that it's inevitable that Hillary Clinton is going to be the candidate, the other thing you're asking is whether there should be primaries or not. And those are two complete different questions.
And Ken, you know, you're somebody who is no stranger to being willing to throw elbows in your own party and then say, at the end of the day, we move forward together.
Right.
You have said so in the past. Do we fret too much, whether we're Republicans or Democrats looking at primaries? Do we think, oh, we can't wound each other too much, we've got to come out of this cleanly, as opposed to saying, I guess what I'm asking is, do you subscribe to the notion of test each other, get tough, or don't wound each other too much?
Well, those in the political know that if you have a candidate who does not have a viable race, you can't be sure that they're actually going to win, that they actually can get votes. And so I'm one of those people who actually believes that the primary part of the electoral process is a good thing, because it does separate the men from the boys, and or the women from the girls, And in Hillary's case, I think that it's going to be an opportunity for her to get over what some have called the He-Man Woman Haters Club. They're going to be going at her for a whole year. She's going to beat back a whole bunch of the things that they're going to try and find out about her. So that by the time she has
on the right or the left, Ken?
I think that what's going to happen is she's going to move slightly to the left, because generally speaking, across the country, it's like 60% of Democrats are turning to the more liberal wing of the Democratic Party. The beauty of that is that then she's going to be able to withstand the onslaught from the third Bush that's going to run for as a Republican. And, you know, you could have a whole hour talking about the fact that is he inevitable as a candidate.
And we
there.
Will. We're only looking left today. We're going to be looking right soon. I didn't know if I could take the whole Bush Clinton hour yet. I don't want to quite. Jesse, you want to jump in?
I just wanted to point out, in terms of the inevitability, the first caucus, I think, is in Iowa, and the second one is in New Hampshire. And Iowa is a caucus state, so it's the most fired up Democrats that participate, and they're very progressive, in our opinion. And then New Hampshire's in the media market of the Boston Globe. So
it's a terrible process, isn't it? I'm always careful, Jesse, as the host of this program, not to project too much. But next week on this program, we're looking at the primary process and how broken it is to never rotate it. You've got two of the least diverse states in the country with so much kingmaking power. It is remarkable.
I don't think I'm in a position to criticize, but what I want to...
Are you afraid of Iowa, too?
What I want to...
Jesse Lanny said he's not going to criticize.
I think I just announced.
That's news.
I just don't know how to criticize. Not that I wouldn't.
Every 20 elections, you can't have New York in the first five. You can't have any other state. It's remarkable to me.
Well, but in a red state, blue state world, everybody is going to have, no matter who comes up first, there's going to be something that's wrong with it. At least this way, as a political analyst, you can look at what happened before and try and gauge what's going to happen in the future.
I guess, but I'm saying rotate it, Ken. I'm saying why not rotate it?
Just one quick point. I just think it makes Elizabeth more viable that she gets to start in those races. And I don't think we need a scandal. I wouldn't bet against Hillary Clinton, but I also wouldn't subscribe that it's anything's inevitable. We think that Elizabeth Warren would be viable, especially given the layout of the primaries.
All right, so some questions starting to come in online. I should have mentioned the phone number, so we're going to get to some of your questions now with our panel as we look at the Democratic presidential primary. And yes, Republican presidential primary coming in the future. Not yet, but we will soon. But we're kind of keeping current in the news as we look at the Hillary Clinton email scuffle, the Boston Globe coming out strong this week for Elizabeth Warren, hoping for a competitive primary. So let me get a couple questions in here from online, and also let you know that if you want to call the program, you can. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. 2016election.com has Hillary Clinton at 5-4 odds. The next best odds go to Joe Biden, 20-1, Elizabeth Warren, 25-1. And then Gary wants to know, curious whether anyone thinks Jim Webb's a viable candidate. He's listed at 30-1. Ken Warner, Jim Webb, former senator and former Republican, in fact.
I think there's too many people between him and the nomination. That simple.
Not viable.
You know, the other reason I don't think he's viable is that when it comes right down to it, the country, and particularly the Democratic Party, cannot afford 8 years of another Bush. And that is the inevitable thing that happens when you put up somebody who can't win, and he can't win.
Jim Webb cannot win.
Can't win. Okay. The national election.
All right. So again, Ken keeps kind of coming back to this idea that you've got to keep your eyes on November 2016, not just the primaries. That's why another reason that you seem to think Hillary Clinton may be challenged, but she will win because Democrats will coalesce around the idea of we can't lose.
I do. And to Jesse's point, I think what will happen is that she'll, and I think Rob mentioned this too, I think that she'll move a little bit in out of the mainstream to appeal to more people.
Anybody else on this panel think Jim Webb is viable? Jesse, no. Anthony?
I just think he has to the conversation. You know, he's the only one currently in the race with his credentials, military background, former defense secretary or assistant secretary. And so I think the same way we're having that conversation about Elizabeth Warren, you have that same conversation on the other side about Jim Webb.
Rob, is Jim Webb running for vice president?
I don't know. It's an interesting idea. If you want to, I don't know if this is a good historical analogy or it's not even historical. It's good to have additional voices. But what kind of voice is he? Is he like a John Huntsman equivalent on the Democratic side? And how far, can that really go, I think, is the question.
Well, Jake wants to know, and I'll start with Rob on this, outside of an incumbent president, has there ever been a party candidate that was nominated without a primary? There will be primaries. I think he's saying any real contest. Has someone run the table and not really been challenged at all in an open election?
Off the top of my head, probably some of my other panelists.
I can't think. And again, that goes back, Ken Warner, to the idea that maybe there's a reason that hasn't happened, that's viewed as not helpful.
Right. I really do believe that. I mean, talking about being a candidate are two entirely different things. And you can't, it's like being under fire. You can't really tell how a candidate's going to do until they are actually under fire, and primaries are a way to find out.
Jesse, you want to add to that?
Nope.
You looked at me. I thought you raised your hand. Nope. See, if you raised your hand, let me reset the panel as we talk about the primary process to come. Jesse Lenny is the Upstate Regional Political Director of the Working Families Party. Ken Warner, a local writer, activist, author, blogger, and former executive director of Unicon, that's a construction and building trades group. Rob Shrum is a professor of political science at the College of Brockport. Anthony Planzinski, campaign and policy consultant, and also the city Democratic leader for the Monroe County Democratic Party. Robert in Rochester, you're first. Go ahead, Robert. Robert, go ahead.
A primary for Hillary Clinton, because I think there is such a knee-jerk negativity on the part of conservatives to her, who have been badgering her for years now, that if she were to lay low until the election itself, there would be less ammunition for those who may be a little concerned about what some consider the Clinton feeling, that they almost a noblesse oblige. So I think she should lay low, let the Republicans each other off, and then come out real strong and positive during the general election.
Okay, so Robert is saying doesn't want a competitive primary, lay low, don't let Clinton fatigue or other ammunition come to the fore, get to the election. Anthony?
That's dangerous. I think especially in this new age of campaigning, social media, I get the idea of laying low, but you just give a platform for all of your either primary challengers who aren't kind of contending. It's kind of like campaign finance now, the way it's set up. You know, you can opt into it, but if you're the only candidate opting into it nationally, you put yourself at such a disadvantage. And unless everybody agrees to do that, she would just be setting herself up for failure. And I think that her answering to this email, scandal right away has really squelched it right away. It just gave an answer out there, and all of the kind of hemming and hawing and all of the questions out there, it just wasn't a buildup of why isn't she answering? How come she's not doing this?
Well, she spent several days not answering.
And I think she saw the cost of that. And that was, I think if we are here today and she still had not said something about the email scandal or the email situation, depending on which side you are and how you want to kind of classify it, we would be having a much different conversation. But the fact that she held a press conference, she talked about it, addressed it in some way, though it may not be in a way that kind of appeases everyone, she has really kind of really lowered the temperature of that flame on her.
All right, Robert, thanks for the call. Ken, to that point, can we possibly get Benghazi out of the way before a general election? Because that's coming too, whether voters want it or not.
I do think that some of those issues will resurface and be regurgitated again. But I will tell you this: while I've never run a presidential campaign, fortunately, I have run a lot of campaigns, and any time I've ever had a candidate who wanted to be a stealth candidate, they didn't win.
What do you tell them if someone says, "Ken, can't we just keep this quiet? I don't really want to engage too much."
What do I tell them?
Yeah.
Goodbye.
I think I'd like to add that I think I hear where the caller is coming from, but I think we just faced the lowest turnout in history in New York State, and maybe not in history, but in like 80 years.
Yeah.
And so our feeling is that if we don't push these candidates to address the issues that are affecting American families, banking, student debt, Social Security, expanding Social Security, then voters are not going to have anything to vote for, and that's how you lose elections, by not inspiring voters to giving voters a reason to come out and vote. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a rare danger. It's like, even if Hillary could get through the primary process without taking some punches, you know, we'll just lose the general because people don't have any reason to vote.
Rob?
I'd just like to add that, you know, recent political science research has shown that some interesting stuff has been done in looking at what the effects of a scandal are. And it does seem like, you know, there is damage when it first comes out, but it fades. So that would logically go towards the idea that the other panelists have suggested, that it's better to get them out, to get the discussion out of the way earlier in the campaign rather than to put it off till later.
And that which does not kill you makes you stronger.
Yeah.
Okay.
And don't let the issue define you. You define the issue right away.
844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. One more quick call before our short break. That's John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. You know, Hillary Clinton, I'm amazed that she stays on her feet like she does. I'd like to get your thoughts on this. Her performance as Secretary of State, I think, was putrid. Look at the chaos the Middle East is in. And Egypt, I think, is the most glaring thing that she blew. It was terrible what happened there. The Muslim Brotherhood come into power, and Mubarak was overthrown based upon our involvement. And look what the Muslim Brotherhood did. And, of course, now it's been straightened out to a certain extent. You look at Syria, you look at Iran, Libya, I wouldn't even mention the Benghazi situation. She's terrible. And as U.S. Senator, she did nothing for New York State. The only thing that she did was block a Republican proposal to reform health care in 2006. She filibustered. Her and Chuck Schumer filibustered the Republican reform bill to health care in 2006. In fact, I remember it well because I called her office and Senator Schumer's office to try to get them off the dime to stop the filibuster. No. But they prohibited that bill getting passed. So anyways, Hillary, what has she done? And is this going to hurt her in this nomination?
Well, before I let the panel respond, John, let me just ask you a question, because I know you're a consistent caller. I know you're a conservative guy. And what's interesting is that when you talk to Democratic voters, they tend to view Hillary, I think accurately so, as more hawkish than many candidates in her field. And some are concerned about supporting her on those grounds. And then you look at foreign policy. I am not saying this to defend her. I'm asking you. Often you hear conservatives say, get rid of Saddam Hussein, get rid of Gaddafi, get rid of Mubarak. These are dictators. They're strong men. They're hurting their people. They may have weapons. And then you get rid of them, and then the vacuum happens. And unfortunately, you don't just get to install someone that makes you happy all the time, and the results can be ugly at times.
Well, there's a difference. Let's take Egypt as an example. Mubarak was a great ally of the United States. Obviously, Saddam Hussein wasn't. And yet, President Obama and Hillary wanted him out and got him out. And look what we got to replace him. It was unbelievable. I think that alone should disqualify her.
I think it's more complex than that. I think Tunisia starts the Arab Spring. I think that there are street demonstrations that were real. And I think you're right. To some degree, plenty of people wanted Mubarak out. But I think it's more complex than saying Hillary and Obama wanted him out and they pointed at him and he was gone.
Well, Obama's got a connection with the Muslim Brotherhood. And I'll tell you, this is...
Okay. Thanks, John. Before we talk about the president's secret connections to Muslim groups, Ken, go ahead.
Well, just that I blaming Hillary Clinton for things that are going on in the Middle East is one step away from being totally absurd. We have to go back to, say, I don't know, 1914, the Sykes-Picot Agreement that caused all the problems.
I don't disagree
that there
it's complex, but how do you evaluate her performance then as Secretary of State? You have to look in some context.
Well, I absolutely think that she probably did better than many people would have done in that situation, considering the disaster that part of the world is in.
Anybody else? Rob?
I think it's interesting, actually, to note that, you know, the one thing where Hillary Clinton has come out and tried to put some distance between her, you know, actual, you know, discussions of policy and how she might differ from how the Obama administration has handled things is in the area of foreign policy and suggesting that she was in favor of acting against Assad in Syria more strongly, you know, pulling out feelers in that direction. So it is interesting. I mean, it goes back to the larger question, you know, that we've been discussing in terms of, you know, getting beyond the horse race and what sort of policy agenda would actually Hillary Clinton advance. You know, we haven't seen very much of that, but in one limited area where their feelers have been put out, it has been in foreign policy.
And Rob brings up the point that one of the things the Democratic Party really needs is a good domestic policy, and I think Jesse would agree with that too.
Well, we're gonna try to get there, Mary. I'll try to answer your question after the break. Mary wants to know: can we get a candidate who doesn't worship Israel? Apparently, she's concerned about. I certainly think the current president and administration are showing a little pushback. I think that's a good idea or not. I think that's a fair characterization. Let's get a short break. Mary, we'll hit your question. We'll talk domestic policy and look at the rest of the field. We'll get back to Martin O'Malley. Kirsten Gillibrand is listed at 35-1. Is she viable? Don't roll your eyes, Ken Warner. We're talking about plenty of different possibilities as we look at the Democratic field with our panel on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on the next Connections, Reshaping Rochester. The series of discussions continues as we look at making Rochester a better and more harmonious place in its environment. That's first hour. Second hour, Bill Calla, Fairport Superintendent, has been working with parents who want to opt their students out of standardized tests. Is he going too far? Is it the right action to take? Join the conversation second hour. Talk to you Wednesday.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Anise & Associates, providing integrated technology, managed services, and cloud-based solutions to New York State since 1970. ANNESE.com/Rochester.
Welcome back to Connections. Anthony Plonzinski is a campaign and policy consultant. Rob Shum is the professor of political science, one of them, at the College of Brockport. Ken Warner is a veteran of dozens of political campaigns. He's an activist, a writer, and the former executive director of Unicon, that's a construction and building trades group. And Jesse Lenny is the upstate regional political director for the Working Families Party. Ken Warner, for the record, was not rolling his eyes at Kirsten Gillibrand. I just perceive Ken to think that the farther down the list you go, the more unrealistic it is. But does Kirsten Gillibrand have a future a higher future than where she is, Ken?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Absolutely, I think so. I think she's a great representative for New York State, and we're fortunate to have the two best senators in the country.
Too soon for her to think about higher office, a national run?
You know, it's never too soon to think about running for higher office. And, you know, anybody who wants to be president of the United States should certainly read Marathon, the story of how a peanut farmer from Georgia became president of the United States. They started 15 years before to get him there for Jimmy Carter.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, right now, Kirsten Gillibrand is, I think at least, very close to the same age Barack Obama was in 2008. And I recall many on this panel really appreciate the work of George Will. And George Will wrote a column saying, Barack Obama ought not wait, that he has caught fire and that he ought to run. This was before he was officially a candidate. And it turned out George Will was right about that. And it would be fascinating to see if Kirsten Gillibrand's interested. But I also suspect with her relationship to Hillary Clinton that door doesn't open unless Hillary Clinton doesn't run. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to get back to the phones in a moment. But Mary wants to know, can we get a candidate who doesn't worship Israel? She's implying that most political leaders worship Israel. Again, that's a characterization that Mary made, not anyone on this panel. Rob, is that going to be a factor? Do voters care enough? Does that move the needle for voters?
I don't really think so. I think support for Israel is widespread. I think it's still a relatively fringe view. Forgive me, Mary, but you know, it's important to have an important debate about this issue, about the relationship. And I think the administration is actually doing that right now. But on the other hand, again, Israel is an anchor of stability in the Middle East, and there are all kinds of shared interests that remain even despite, you know, the recent kerfuffle.
Okay. Well, before I get back to those phones that are ringing again, 844-295-TALK, another name that came up earlier this hour was Martin O'Malley, former governor of Maryland. And O'Malley has been talked about as somebody who would advance that domestic agenda if Elizabeth Warren won't. And Jesse, as someone who supports Elizabeth Warren, do you view Martin O'Malley as a contender if your preferred candidate isn't there?
I honestly don't know a whole lot about Martin O'Malley. I know we actually have some local friends here that know Martin personally, but I think we'd be happy with several candidates advancing a domestic policy that looks like the type of issues that we champion. So.
Give me a few examples that are bullet points that stand out for the Working Families Party that you think a Democratic presidential contender would adopt and are realistic planks for a platform.
We have to address financial regulation. We have to address fair taxes for super rich, the 1%. We have to address student debt, the crisis of student debt. We have to expand Social Security, not slash and burn it. That would be it.
Okay. Anthony?
Well, I think what struck me is that this was a few months ago when we were talking about education policy. I think Governor O'Malley had made the comment that the best piece of education policy to come out of the Obama administration was actually the Health Care Act. And so the idea that a candidate gets the idea of how social issues and our society around us are, you know, affecting the way our students are educated and then reciprocating that and how our students become leaders is, I think, a very forward-thinking idea, especially from a leader that high up to make such a statement. I think it kind of strikes the idea when you read earlier about how he's running the campaign that most want Elizabeth Warren to get in the race and run. You see those highlights there. And again, I really highlight the 2008 situation with Barack Obama again and how, you know, he was someone who had caught fire, but at the same time, Hillary was there. And so I see O'Malley as the dark horse in the race.
So right now, what this panel sees is a Clinton O'Malley ticket.
Did I say that? Or did I roll my eyes again?
No, you didn't.
potentially, but you know that all shakes. It's 2015.
Well, but I do think that some of these domestic issues are going to have to be addressed. Listen, I mean, we have an educational system not just in Rochester, New York, but across the country that's falling apart and failing the next generation. We have, again, using Rochester, New York as a little microcosm, we're convening these giant groups of people to attack poverty because it's one of the worst things that's eating away at America. The problem of jobs and the overseas transportation of those jobs has to be addressed. If we spent as much time on domestic policy as we do taking steps back and rebuilding Afghanistan, we'd be in a lot better shape.
We also heard Anthony mention healthcare. Does this panel think that Democrats have conceded too much ground in the debate over the Affordable Care Act? For example, the president rallied support, got it to pass, and then you almost saw Democrats immediately retreat and almost apologizing for it, and Republicans whacking with them in the midterms with that. Was that a tactical mistake? Do you think Democrats should be more full-throatedly supporting the Affordable Care Act? And do you suspect that Hillary Clinton or the next candidate will? Ken Warner?
Yeah, I absolutely do think that Democrats need to be supporting it more. But I will tell you, one of the reasons that I think that it has done as poorly as it has, all due respect to you, is when you find news reporters calling it Obamacare instead of the Affordable Care Act, which is what it should be called. Obamacare was something that was invented by Republicans to make people not like it. And they're successful. They're very successful at that sort of public relations thing. And listen, you go around the world and you find that there are places all over that treat their people, have governments that treat their people way better than the United States. We're not first in things like education. We're not first in things like healthcare. We're not first in things like women's rights. And those are the issues that should be paid attention to. And the only people who are going to talk about those are Democrats.
Well, go ahead, Jesse.
I think what all candidates need to do, federal candidates, is talk about how the Affordable Care Act has gotten millions of people health care they wouldn't have had, has saved employers money, has saved families money. I mean, once you start to describe to the American people what the Affordable Care Act actually does, they like it.
Okay, but why weren't they doing that almost immediately after it passed? Why did we see such retreat?
was a mistake.
That was a mistake.
Yeah. A mistake, Anthony?
That was definitely a mistake. I mean, you can't run away from your base. And I think you can look at examples on the local level to the state level to the national level. When you run away from your base, they don't vote for you. And they are kind of conflicted on who you are as a candidate and what you represent. And I think that had not President Obama righted that wrong midway through his campaign, then we could have seen a different outcome there. But he went headstrong into it after the convention and being unapologetic for the jobs that were the jobs that were added, the savings that were made through the health care, through the Affordable Care Act, and all of those positives, and really ran towards it saying, you know what, we are better than we were 4 years from now. And I think that was a telling strategy that helped him win re-election.
Well, let me turn to Rob Shum, who's the political science professor at Brockport on the panel. Look, I go back to 2004, Republicans helped pass Medicare Part D. And I remember talking to staffers off the record who would tell me, and it's ancient history enough to know that I think I can say this. They'd say, look, we're taking an issue away from Democrats. We're going to pass Part D. They said it was going to be $400 billion. A month after the election, they said, oops, it's $550 billion. But they passed it. And I've never seen health care passed by a party that then retreated. Often, health care is passed sort of proudly. And have you ever seen a scenario like that, that we saw with the Affordable Care Act? Its passage and then almost immediate retreat.
No, it was a unique situation, I think, and of course politicians react to short-term tactical considerations, and that's what we saw. And it seems, historians will look back and not be able to understand this. I think actually the healthcare issue is actually a time bomb or landmine for the Republicans. If they're going to continue to run against it, that's going to be a huge advantage for whoever the Democratic candidate is, who will presumably simply have to say, well, we're going to keep the health care reform. They want to take it away. And that's just handing over a huge chunk of support to the Democrats.
We saw Ted Cruz, who is Jesse Linney's not your first choice, say at his announcement yesterday, imagine a president in January 2017 repealing every single word. As if, by the way, that the president just gets to walk in and whatever you want to do, Mr. President, you do. But he's saying repeal every single word. Doesn't play in the election, huh?
No, I don't think so. I think that's a guy who claims he's a supporter of the Constitution, wants to be emperor of the United States. But I think what someone is going to point out eventually, too, is that the Affordable Care Act is doing so much better in Democratic states where they've taken the federal money, where they've implemented it properly. And because of the neoconservatives on the Republican Party, the neo-Confederates who want to talk about state rights, that bill gave a lot of states' rights to states that have Republican legislators and Republican governors, and they gutted the program. So it's not even fair to look at it nationally because it's the Republican legislatures and Republican governors who are sabotaging the health care of their own people. And so at some point, someone's going to point that out, and that's going to make their argument even less acceptable to the voters.
Well, let me turn to the guy who's probably had the most experience, not only in the trenches of campaigns, but also understanding that sometimes you do just have to work to raise money, and that's Ken Warner. This is the part that people don't always like about politics. And when you look at this field, Hillary Clinton could raise a lot of money very quickly. Jeb Bush could raise a lot of money very quickly. But do you want to see Ken as someone who understands that part of the process on the local level, on different levels? Do we need to change the system and the way campaigns are funded?
The answer to that is yes and no.
Known you to be
right. Right. Well, let me tell you why. One of the things that people have to remember is that if you want to run for office for the office of mayor in the city of Rochester, and you want to be on television for a week, it costs you $100,000. That means if you have two candidates that are running, it's $200,000. If you want to run for 4 weeks, you've spent $1 million. You haven't actually done anything else. If you don't spend that kind of money, everybody accuses you of not talking to voters. The fact of the matter is that the only way that we're going to get to a solution to this is with campaign finance reform and publicly financed campaigns. However, you will note that the fact of the matter is that the amount of money that they're allocating for it do not allow people to get their message out. It costs money. How much does it cost to put a stamp on an envelope? doesn't cost 5 cents anymore. It costs 50 cents to put a stamp on an envelope. If you've got 10 voters, that's $5. If you've got 100 voters, that's $50. If you've got millions of voters, it's a lot of money. When was the last time anybody got a piece of mail for a presidential candidate? It hasn't been since I was a kid, and these guys weren't even born.
So I think what you're saying is it probably does need to happen, but it's more expensive than people realize.
That's exactly what
I'm saying. Does that mean, though, that you're still okay with it, that you're saying it's going to be more expensive than we realize, but we should do it?
Yes, absolutely, yes.
Wow.
The one thing I would say, though, is to put some of the power back in the voters, an informed electorate can make elections a lot less expensive, because if people went to these candidates' websites and learned everything about both sides and voted based on that, you wouldn't need TV ads. So voters have the power to make these campaigns cheaper.
That was an eye roll that I just had.
Ken finally really did roll his eye.
I mean, I think it's not inevitable that these races have to be huge. But given the reality, the next step is public financing to make them more reasonable.
But Rob, the reason Ken might have rolled his eyes is because that's an idealistic thought. And it's a great thought. And I know as a professor of political science, you'd love to embrace that. Is it realistic?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's difficult to imagine it without, further frustration, without voters actually demanding a change, without maybe possibly some crisis like we talked about last time before people will really demand it. It's just not something that people think about, even though, in the back of our heads and serious people tut-tut about it. I mean, obviously, it is, it's the underlying reason. It's the reason why we can't get fundamental change or a serious policy discussions is because of this, the effects of money. But getting at it, it's just hard. I think Ken, and Ken's explained some of the reasons for it.
Jonathan wants to know if the panel thinks that misogyny played into Hillary Clinton's 2008 loss in the primaries.
We're not the right people to discuss.
No, you're right. Thank you very much. Thank you, Rob.
That's where I tell the listeners, I really did think we can't have an all-male panel. It's just the way it shook out. So that's the host's fault for failing to round out a little more balanced panel. It's just one of those who's available and who's not on this day.
I mean, and I think the point to speak to about that is the infamous flowery couch, the floral couch pattern, and when Hillary made that speech from the couch, and how much we talked about, her femininity became an issue on that campaign. And I think we're not the right ones to dissect this all the way through, but I think there you see a way in which it did really play into it. And there are some pieces out there now saying, is she not able to connect? And I think women are definitely judged more harshly when it comes to their ability to connect. You brought up earlier that she was a hawk, and I think some people use that against her and try to make her anti-women for that. And I think that is a problem, and was a problem in 2008, and it will be a problem in this election too, and one that should be fixed. But unfortunately, it's gonna rail against her.
I think a broader issue that we have to address, especially people that do politics, we have to break down the barriers for women to run for office. We have in state office in New York State, there's 20% of the legislators women, and 60% of the voters are women. So I think we have to address the additional difficulties that women have running for office, and we have to figure out a way to mitigate those difficulties and encourage more women to run and support more women running in general.
Yeah. Let me ask the panel a question that I'm mostly serious about. Andrew Cuomo listed at 50-1. I've never thought he has the kind of personal, the mentality to run for. And I don't say this again with any derision, just observationally. He doesn't like talking to voters. And he would have to do it at a scale the likes of which he's never had to experience, going to the early primary states, going to sort of that ridiculous sort of circuit of fairs and baby kissings and whatnot. And Andrew Cuomo is just not that kind of a guy. So absent everything else, is he... would he be gunning for attorney general, or does anybody here think that he still wants that?
I think he still wants it.
You do.
But I think that there is that very practical matter. And the smart money says that he really does have a problem with that retail campaigning. And when you go through the primary process, that's a huge part of it. If you're going to go through Iowa and not talk to voters face-to-face, you ain't going to win.
Anybody else? Jesse, Andrew Cuomo, a viable presidential idea for you?
We have not discussed anything about the governor.
Anthony?
I think the larger issue is kind of the Kirsten Gillibrand issue. Is he's from New York, and he worked in the Clinton administration. You know, so it would have to be Clinton would have to back out of the race completely, I would think, before he would take a shot at that. If not, we have a pretty interesting situation on our hands.
And the other thing that I would say is there were a lot of people who put nails in the coffin of Andrew Cuomo when he and Carol McCall had their set to some years ago. He's now the governor.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's an important point here. We are way too quick to pronounce someone's political career over, I think, as we have seen time and time again. All right, let's start to wrap with this. There's nothing more useless than predictions, so let's do some of those. Just because we'll keep this recording, and then we'll come back and hold you to it. Anthony Planzinski, you're going to say Hillary Clinton's the nominee. Does she lose any states?
In terms of the Democratic
primary. The Democratic
primary.
Does she lose any states?
Absolutely. I think... I don't think anybody's going to walk it. I think that any candidates out there, whether it be Webb in Virginia, whether it be O'Malley in Maryland and others, I think she will lose one or two states. I do think she is the odds-on favorite right now.
But you're talking about a near sweep anyway.
If the election were held today, you got to do that. If the election were held today, it would be a near sweep.
Okay.
But it's not being held today, and so because if the election were to be held at this time, 8 years ago, I'd say the same thing about her, and Barack Obama would be our president.
That's right. Ken?
Do I think she's going to sweep?
Yeah.
No, I do not. I do think that they're going to be the country's too diverse in too many ways. She's going to be too liberal in some cases and too conservative in other. But when all is said and done, she is going to win, and Jesse Linney's going to be her vice presidential candidate.
Jesse hasn't considered that as an option yet, but Jesse?
I haven't ruled it out either.
Yeah,
I don't think it's going to be a sweep. I think that we're going to work hard to support lots of candidates talking about our issues and have a vibrant debate, which will mean it won't be a sweep. I think if we thought we could predict, we wouldn't be drafting.
I know, it's a total waste of time, but it's fascinating to me just to see the mentality because it is not that different than 8 years ago. And maybe, if Elizabeth Warren got into the race tomorrow, I think that would be a fascinating dynamic change in many, many ways. She keeps saying, and she told Fortune magazine in January, categorically not happening. We'll see. Jesse's going to try to change her mind. Rob, is she going to lose any states?
Anything's possible. I'll just leave it at that.
Thanks, everybody. And for our listeners, again, we're going to hit the Republican side of this coming up soon to try to get a feel for that. But there's the lay of the land as we look at the Democratic race. Everybody go back to your local races. It's fun to look national for a little while. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Great panel today. Thanks for listening. I'm Evan Dawson. Val, great job. This is Member Supported Public Radio.